Okay. This is a oral history interview with Dr. Tor Bergstrahl.
Correction, no doctor.
Okay, Mr. Tor Bergstrahl. In his office at the Aerospace Corporation in El Segundo, California. The interviewer, David Dvorkin. The date, August 1st, 1983. Well, I guess I thought I saw here a PhD for you in your who's who.
if so, it's an error.
Okay, well, we'll straighten out the record.
I never did complete it.
Okay. When and where were you born, and who were your parents?
Well, I was born in a very small town in Minnesota called Graston, which is in east central Minnesota. And my parents were Carl L. Bergstrahl, and my mother was Augusta Bergstrahl. My father was a blacksmith.
Oh, really?
And an immigrant from Sweden, mm-hmm. having come from the Malmo region in Sweden.
The what region?
Malmo, which is M-A-L-M-O, which is the very southern tip of Sweden.
Uh-huh.
And he came over as about 18, 19 years old with the trade of blacksmith. My mother was also born in Sweden, but she came here as about a one-year-old child with her parents. Uh-huh. And of course, when I was about 1 year old, we moved to another place. They're called North Branch, which is about 45 miles north of St. Paul on the road to on the Twin City to Duluth Highway. Mm-hmm. And we there's where I grew up and went to grade school and high school.
Mm-hmm. Did you go through public schools the entire
yes.
time?
Yes, oh yes, okay. Yeah.
Were you an only child?
No. There were six of us. I was the second out of six.
Okay. Did you have brothers or sisters that went on to college also?
One brother who went on to college. Mm-hmm. The others did not. And he went on to college after the war. He was a Marine and went to college on the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. And I got into college in a peculiar way, having graduated from high school in 32 when things were extremely difficult.
Right.
I was worked around and finally wound up in the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Oh, yeah.
And in the fall of 1936, the president of Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota, was Dr. Donald J. Cowling, offered to take one of the CCC boys and sponsor him, in a sense, at the college if the CCC would pick him out. Hmm. They actually selected about six of us, and then Dr. Cowling was to make the final selection, and he picked two. And so the two of us went down to Carleton, and as a matter of fact, we both were able to stay there and graduate in good shape. So that's how we got to college, in spite of the financial condition.
So prior to that, you really had no idea that you were going to go to college?
No, because, well, I did when I was in high school. I had hopes, but say the economic conditions that following 32 and, of course, then the bank holiday, all monies that were available were all tied up. So there wasn't any real possibility of doing anything at that time.
What did you want to do? What did you get interested in high school?
Well, frankly, when I was in high school, I wanted to study law. Mm-hmm. And then I'm afraid the 4 years had intervened, and I'll admit that it was in college that I became interested in physics. And since we were required to take sciences, one of the first science I took was physics, and it turned out to be more interesting than it had been in high school by quite a bit. Mm.
Was there a particular teacher that you liked?
Oh, yes. It was Dr. Culver was the the teacher. And while he was a bit of Puritan, he was also a very good teacher, and I enjoyed what went on. And then through the 4 years that I was there taking other courses, there were other instructors who were, as I say, quite interesting, and so the whole it came around to the fact that I decided I would major in physics, probably with no good idea of what I could do afterwards, because physics at that time was not exactly a commercial type of of major.
Did you take any astronomy while you were there? Because Carleton had a little observatory.
Yes, they did, as a matter of fact. No, I did not. They had an observatory. They had a also the what was at that time popular astronomy was published there.
That's right.
And Dr. Gingrich was the was that, and Dr. Fath was a specialist on variable stars. So we knew about variable stars, even though we didn't study astronomy.
Okay.
The college was small; it was about 800 students.
Yeah.
And so there was a certain amount of information you picked up by osmosis, even though you didn't take the courses.
That's right.
Right.
Let me back up a little bit and ask you about the possible influence that your father had on you. Being a blacksmith and working with metal and doing things mechanical, so to speak, did you gain a facility? Did you early on help him out in the shop?
Not a great deal in the shop. I did help him more, well, as I say, later when he was trying shoeing horses, etc. It turned out that in the later years, when I was about 14, 15, 16, which is at that time, the situation had changed, and farmers no longer brought their horses into town for trimming their feet and shoeing them if they were needed. And they did not need shoes as much because they didn't use them on the highways the way they had before. But I would go out and help him then because it was quite often necessary to restrain the horses. They were not accustomed to having their feet picked up or anything like that, since unlike the people who have riding horses and so on, the farmers did not do much petting around with their horses, picking up their feet and doing things like that. So it was necessary to restrain them, and I'd give him help that way. I did help him some, as my brothers did in the shop, with some work where it needed two people to be able to hold something where a piece was too big or something like that. But my father was never anxious. In fact, he was quite anxious that we do not follow him in the trade of blacksmithing, and of course it was understandable because that was a trade that was essentially dying in the 30s. That is, the advent of the automobile and the truck and so on had, and the tractor was changing it a great deal. The major share of the work that he had done, such as even the repairing of wagons, the making of sleighs, and the, of course, work with horses, was beginning to disappear pretty rapidly. And so it was not a career that one would attempt to follow. And I'll admit, my parents were quite anxious that I go on to school, and it was a bit of a disappointment that at the time that I graduated from high school that I could not go on, but as it turned out, it worked out by accident and by luck, however you wish to call it.
Good. Now, in Carleton, you were studying physics. What kind of physics did you get interested in?
Well, in Carleton, of course, we had the more general physics and in the sense, the classical physics of and thermodynamics, etc. And of course, Dr. Culver was particularly interested in electronics at that time, since he had he was fundamentally, although a PhD in physics, he was an electronics engineer. He had been chief engineer on the Canadian Broadcasting System when it was built back in the late in the early 20s, and then had come on to, and was back to teaching physics. And so there was a great deal of that that we did there in the way of electricity, the electrical and electronic, good old vacuum tube work. My interest, however, did get over to, in the last year or so that I was there, into the area of nuclear physics, because exciting things were happening in nuclear physics in 39 and 40. And so that's when it turned out that I was able to go on from there to the University of Minnesota in graduate school. It was in nuclear physics that I wanted to really study and work.
So you were aware at Carleton College of the advances in nuclear physics in the late 30s?
Oh yes, we certainly knew of the things that were happening.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not in great detail, but because we didn't have very any great course in nuclear physics, it was I guess not a really up-to-date course. It was, however, it was brought up to date by the people who were teaching it, who were acquainted with the literature and told us what was happening, and we would then read the literature. So we were aware of what was going on in a real sense. Physical Review was readable at that time.
As an undergraduate for you?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Do you recall any of the major textbooks? Did you have Rickmeyer by any chance?
No, not in not there. We used Rickmeyer when I got to the University of Minnesota, and we were teaching there. No, Dr. Culver had his own general physics text, and I can't remember the others. I'd have to dig back. I know there was a thermodynamics text, and I can't remember the name of the author. But
did you have laboratory?
Oh yes, we had laboratory, and but there, of course, it covered a great deal of things, and in nuclear physics, not too much. Hmm. Like the Millikan oil drop experiment we performed is one, as everybody performed, was one that that I recall that we did at that time.
All right. Now, as you were graduating from Carleton, did you have options as to where you would go for graduate school or whether you would go to work?
Well, in a sense, I had the option. I did consider going to work and did some checking around and found that even in 1940, there was not a great deal available. I have to admit that when I applied for work at various places and admitted that I was I had majored in physics at college, it didn't seem to help. It seemed to to be more of a. But I had the opportunity then of going on to graduate school at the University of Minnesota, which was my preference in any event. I really wanted to go on to graduate school, but I did investigate the possibility of going to work because of the economic conditions.
Did you? Let's see. What am I trying to say? Listen, you went to Carleton in
36.
In 36. Okay. Mm-hmm. You'd already been in the CCC for how many years?
Year and a half.
Okay, fine. So then you graduated in 40.
40, right.
All right. So was there any particular program at Minnesota that most intrigued you? Was there another school that you considered going to, possibly like Chicago?
Well, yes, but as I say, while I did look at others, there was one, as I remember, that was somewhat of interest to me, which was medical physics at the University of Rochester, as I
mm-hmm.
recall.
Yes.
And I was somewhat interested in that. And I think the matter of convenience at Minnesota, I was able to go up there, of course, and talk to them directly.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was only 45 miles away from Northfield.
Yeah.
And when I met Dr. Buchta and the others there and talked to them, and they said, sure, we'd be delighted to have you come here.
Dr. who?
Buchta, J.W., that was J, just the initial, William,
mm-hmm.
and B-U-C-H-T-A. He was the head of the department at Minnesota at that time.
Right, he was the one I heard about. Okay.
Yeah. When they offered me a teaching assistantship there, I accepted immediately. I thought that that was a very good possibility and much better than taking the gamble on being able to get something somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. So that was a position that allowed you full support. In other words, you weren't dependent on your family at all?
No, I was not. I couldn't really be. They were having enough economic problems of their own.
Yeah.
Yes, it allowed full support. I think we got $600 for 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so that amounted to about $67 a month on which we lived, which we managed to do in the early 40s. It was possible,
mm-hmm.
because strangely enough, you could get a dinner for like 50 cents.
Right. That's true. Well, what was the atmosphere like at the University of Minnesota? What were your required courses, and how did you do?
Well, we had, of course, the required courses were such as theoretical physics, for which we used the text from Page, and there were, of course, quantum mechanics that came later, and of course, a more advanced thermodynamics, trying to remember them. I can remember electrodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to remember the name of the was her name Phillips? Anyway, there was one. She wrote a book with on electrodynamics later with a fellow from Stanford. And I should remember the name, and maybe later I will, and
okay.
bring it back, because she was there for a couple of years and was a very interesting lecturer. That's why I remember.
This was a woman?
Yes, a woman. And I'm just trying to...
She wasn't part of the Cosmic Ray group?
No.
Okay.
No. No. As a matter of fact, there were really wasn't a Cosmic Ray group at Minnesota at that time.
Hmm.
They came sort of after the war, when people like the Friars, both George and Phyllis Fryer were there, and Ed and I,
mm-hmm.
and who were graduated from Minnesota, and mm-hmm. then others who came in there and worked on cosmic rays, including Frank Oppenheimer.
Yeah, but none of them were there the time you were there.
Well, yes, George and Phyllis Fryer were, and Ed and I were in graduate school at the same time I was.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, let's keep going on the graduate school then. Were you focusing in on some particular area of physics to do a dissertation or getting interested in it?
Well, things became a little hectic, as you can remember, at that time. Yes, I was... because I started working with Dr. John Williams,
mm-hmm.
and he had a Van de Graaff there at the time, and we were working on various cross-section measurements, and mm-hmm. so I was preparing to do a thesis in one of those fields. But then, of course, with the war breaking out and the as a matter of fact, that whole organization got wound up in the Manhattan Project. And as a result, we were working pretty much on that, so that even our coursework began to drop off pretty heavily because we weren't able to spend that much time on it.
Mm-hmm.
We were between doing some teaching in the laboratories, and that is, which the graduate students did, that is, they handled the laboratories for the general physics courses and so on. Then, between that and the work we were doing from the Manhattan Project, which was primarily neutron cross-sections,
mm-hmm.
There wasn't a great deal of time, and it was becoming clear that that those of us who were in that area were probably either going to have to change our field and write a thesis in some area other than nuclear physics, or we were going to have to wait until the war was over when the Manhattan Project had finally cleared up. Mm-hmm. And so that was the direction things were going. Then, of course, in early 43, the Manhattan Project people moved us to Los Alamos. Mm-hmm. We didn't know it as Los Alamos at the time, but we knew that they were operating somewhere near Santa Fe because that was there. I was, Dr. Buchta actually talked me into staying because they had a lot of military students coming in. That is, there we had the Navy V-12, we had the Army pre-meteorology, the Army pre-flight program, and also the so-called ASTP program.
ASTP?
Yes, Army Specialized Training Program, I think it was, that provided. And V-12, as you know, really kept students in to get a degree. Mm-hmm. The Army programs did not. They were short-term, relatively short-term, up to a year or so programs, where there was a concentrated effort in certain areas of mathematics, chemistry, and physics to get people prepared for certain fields. One of them was meteorology, and so we had about 500 students there. I think it turned out we had 500 students in each of the categories.
You must have done a lot of teaching.
As a result, they had to round up and shift graduate students over to teaching. Of course, what we were teaching was more or less sophomore physics, if you want. And at that time, we were using, depended on which group we were working with, we were using Rickmeyer. Mm-hmm. Not Rickmeyer.
No, I didn't think so.
A general physics and a well-known one at the time, and there was, a matter of fact, a Naval Academy edition, which we used with the pre-flight people, and so we were using about two different texts, working with these different groups. But that went on until spring of 1944, and at that time, the situation with the draft became clear that in spite of these things that were going on, the draft board would no longer agree to my being deferred. And
I see.
The choice was, what should I do? I could probably have gone to Los Alamos, but having a crazy streak, I guess, I decided I would apply for a commission in the Navy, which I did.
Oh, for an actual commission?
Yes,
okay.
For a direct commission.
What kind of crazy streak? I mean, was...
Just a feeling that if the draft board wants me, I'll join the services.
Fair enough.
But I'll join them on my terms, not theirs.
Where were you as far as your graduate education was concerned? Had you completed all your
coursework? I had essentially completed all my coursework by that time. I had had taken a master's in the interim. When I saw what was happening, I decided that I'd try to get a master's degree because things might turn out that I'd get interrupted, which was the way it happened. But I had essentially completed all of the coursework that I would have needed, but I would have needed a thesis, which at the time, from 43 to the time I left a year later, there was really nobody there to work with in nuclear physics.
Right.
They were all gone.
You had chosen nuclear physics.
Yes. Yes, I had, and had been working with, as I say, with John Williams.
Yeah.
And but those people were all gone at that time. And my memory for names now is troubling a little bit, because there was the man who invented the mass spectrograph, had been there, and came back later.
Mm.
Fine fellow. And
yeah.
I'm sure, you know, if you mentioned the name, you'd recognize it immediately, and so on. So, oh, by the way, the woman I was trying to tell you about in electrodynamics was Melba Phillips.
Oh. Sure, Melba Phillips.
Right.
Okay.
I was thinking of Mabel Phillips, and I knew that was wrong, but Melba Phillips, and a very interesting individual.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I've heard of her. Now, you took the commission.
Right.
To do what?
Well, obviously, when you applied for a commission, their position was that everything was open.
Mm-hmm.
I did request that I be sent to radar school and go on through the radar point of it, and they more or less allowed us how that was probably highly unlikely, but nevertheless, that's what happened. Within a few weeks, I had orders to pre-radar school at Bowdoin College and then on to MIT for the radar school, which took up a big share of the next year, those two together.
Mm-hmm.
So I wound up in about March of 1945. I was then assigned to the radiation laboratory at MIT as part of the Navy liaison group, and actually assigned to the shipboard radar group there under Richard Emberson.
Mm-hmm. What were your duties then as liaison?
Well, there my duties as liaison were to be a member of the group working on shipboard radar, say my duties were no different than any of the other members of the group. I was just one of the group.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason, I guess, for having a liaison person there, if you want to call it that, was, as it did turn out later, there were times when it was necessary to go out on board ship with something, and they always had to have a Navy officer go with the civilians from the laboratory.
I see.
And so I served that purpose. In other words, when we did that, I would go along as the Navy escort for the civilians.
Uh-huh.
For some reason or other, the Navy people were usually very nervous about having civilians on board their ships.
Hmm.
And maybe in wartime that's a reasonable attitude.
There was a man I've interviewed in the past who was involved in shipboard radar. His name was John Hall. Does that ring a bell at all?
Yes, he was there. I did not know him very well. There was, it was a fairly large operation there, but the division that we were in was Dr. Street from Harvard, and Dr. Emberson was our particular immediate
mm-hmm.
group leader, and there were other groups in that division.
Mm-hmm.
And Hall was had one of those.
Yeah, he was in mm-hmm. a different part.
Yeah.
While you were in Cambridge, then, did you go to any colloquia or maintain your interest in nuclear physics in any way?
No, it was pretty difficult. Matter of fact, we were pretty well tied up, and so there was not much opportunity to go to anything of that kind. That is, they usually occurred at a time when we were working.
Yeah.
Sundays was not a day for colloquia.
Right. What did you usually do on Sundays?
Well, it varied. Some of the times we just rested, but some of the time we would go out to, like, the baseball games if there were. One of the Boston teams was in town. We'd go out and watch them mm-hmm. and do a few things like that so as to get a little relaxation for the weekend.
Now, how long were you at the radiation lab?
Well, actually, I got in there about March of 1946, and as you know...
Oh, March of 46 or 5?
45, I'm
45,
sorry.
45, right.
And as you know, in August of 45, things begin to... Mm-hmm. They came apart there very quickly at the end mm-hmm. of the war. And people were going elsewhere. And as a result, of course, being in the Navy, I couldn't go elsewhere. I had to have some assignment, and so I was assigned to the Navy Patent Office that was attached there and was being the engineering consultant to the Patent Office. That is, they had patent lawyers and they had
mm-hmm.
Who were in there, but they needed people who could interpret the work that was coming in from the lab. And in many cases, the notes were, you know, sort of incomplete, or in a sense, they were certainly not easy for laymen to read that had been done. And so I was assigned over there. At the same time, interestingly enough, the group from NRL, which Dr. Krause led, was coming to the Rad Lab and was interviewing people for recruiting them to come down to the Naval Research Laboratory.
Can you give me an approximate date for that recruitment?
Well, that should have been in like September and October of 1945.
Okay.
That they were in there.
I'm very interested in what, if you recall, anything about what they said NRL was up to at that time.
Well, of course, they were NRL was involved in radar and all of that. And as I say, Dr. Krause's group was working on guided missiles and were pointing out that. So there were a whole number of things. But I know they were very interested in radar people because I think there was a feeling that with the Rad Lab dissolving, there had to be somewhere where all of this radar work was going to go. They didn't want it to stop. And of course, so they were making an effort to build up a pretty good radar group there too, which they did. And so in many of the areas of electronics, they were looking for people.
Mm-hmm.
They would, as a matter of fact, they were running an airplane shuttle service up there, and they would take people down to NRL and show them around.
Really? Did you go?
No, I did not. I had been there. As a matter of fact, in a sense, it was not necessary. I had been sent down there as a part of my work at the Rad Lab as being a naval Navy liaison officer. I had been sent to a visit to NRL to see what it was all like. So I had spent about 2-3 days down there several months earlier. And so I was pretty well aware of what was going on. And probably the most important thing about it was that there was a Dr. Gilbert Perlow, P-E-R-L-O-W, who was with that group, and he had been at the University of Minnesota. And so I had known him there, and he had known me, and he convinced me that probably I'd be well off to go down there. By this time, of course, I had a wife and a child, and so I was, it was not as economically feasible for me to go back to graduate school as it probably should have been. But
so that was a factor?
That was a factor in my going on and going down to NRL and taking work there rather than going back.
Even on the GI Bill and that sort of thing?
No, it didn't. Well, the GI Bill, of course, wasn't available at that time, you know, right at the end. It took, if I remember correctly, a year or so before that came around to pass, by which time I was deeply involved.
When were you married?
I was married in 1942, and I met her in Minneapolis.
Okay. That's straightforward.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm very interested, though, in what Gilbert Perlow or Krause had said to you, and if there's any way you might recall what kinds of projects they were getting into.
Well, as I say, they were at that time primarily discussing the matter of the guided missiles, or what might, I guess, more closely be called smart bombs today, sense that they were short-range guided missiles, and that was the type of thing that they were continuing to work on and were preparing to develop.
Between September and October, when they interviewed you.
When they were interviewing me at that time, that was their discussion. As a matter of fact, Homer Newell was also in the group at that time.
So can I then assume that there was virtually no discussion of the exploitation of V-2s at that
time?
No,
there was not at that time, although, and I'm not sure whether, well, in fact, I'm reasonably confident that Dr. Krause was not at that time aware of the fact that the V2s would become available. He didn't, I don't think he, that became known until about January of 1946.
Okay.
That that was going to happen. So a lot of things happened between the September.
Do you want to, I can put this on pause if you want some water.
The, you see, a lot of things happened in that interval, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And one of them clearly was the decision of that group to do something other than that. They had decided to do upper atmosphere research before they were aware that they would have the availability of the V2s.
Mm-hmm. That was quite evident to you.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know anything about it because while I had hoped and had tried, thought I had an arrangement that I was going to be transferred from Radlab to NRL as a Navy officer to complete the time period that I'd have to serve, that didn't work out. The patent office there decided that they couldn't dispense with any help that they had.
I see.
Which was probably true, they did need the help. And so as a result, I had to stay there in Boston until the end of March of 1946, mm-hmm. at which time I was shipped back to the Midwest for processing out of the Navy, and then came down in May to the NRL. And it was when I arrived there that I discovered that we were in a new field.
That's right.
Which, as a matter of fact, I was quite happy with. Delighted to be able to work in that rather than in guided missiles. It seemed like a more interesting subject to me. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we began doing.
During this period, did you have any contact with Krause or with Perlow by mail, possibly?
Very little, very little. It was, I had, not really by mail. They had, as I remember, I think they had come up and Dr. Krause had been up to the remains of Radlab a couple times through the winter, and he and we had talked, and he was aware of the fact that I would have to stay at Radlab until my service period. I had earned enough points so that I could get out, and he had assured me that, well, that was fine. I would still be welcomed at NRL when I became free to come.
So you'd made the decision that you would go to NRL after that?
Right? Yes, I made the decision. I had been interrogated by some other companies and so on, but I had chosen NRL, and one of the reasons, frankly, was that there appeared to be the possibility of doing some further graduate work mm-hmm. with the University of Maryland while there.
Did that work out?
Well, yes, I took some more courses there, but I never did prepare a thesis there. I guess I just was too busy working on what we were doing to get involved there. A couple of the people did, so it was a feasible program.
Was there any pressure at NRL for you to get the PhD?
No.
Mm-hmm. Good. You indicated that you were delighted with this change of project goal. What did you see in it of personal interest?
Well, I thought that it was a good research program, and of course by that time the V2s were available, and so the feeling that this was a really new field of research where other people had not been able to do because they the vehicles to reach those areas just had not been available. This seemed to me like a very nice thing to do. Now I wanted to, obviously cosmic rays was the closest to nuclear physics that was in there. On the other hand, there was a rather good group there already doing cosmic ray work.
Who was in that group then?
Well, of course, Dr. Krause was interested in that himself.
Right.
And he had, Dr. Perlow was there, and a fellow by the name of Sergei Golian.
Yeah. What was his background?
Well, he had, if I remember correctly, his undergraduate work was at Case, and he did graduate work at the University of Chicago. in which he had done work on cosmic rays up in Colorado,
with Shine
at Chicago.
Yeah.
And he was an interesting fellow in the sense that he was born in Turkestan, raised in China, and came to the United States to go to college, he went to Staunton Military Academy, as I remember. We were pretty good friends afterwards, so I knew pretty well. And then he had been at Rad Lab and had been overseas in the London part of Rad Lab and came to NRL from there.
Okay. Do you know if Golian or Gilbert Perlow are still around? I think.
Are still around?
Yeah.
Perlow is. He's at the the lab just outside of Chicago.
The Argonne?
Argonne. Yeah, he's been there for years, and he's still there. I don't know whether he's still editor of the Physical Review Letters or not. He was.
I can check that easily, you know,
yeah.
Sure.
Golian, unfortunately, died last year, so he's not around anymore.
Oh, okay. Well, you came in May of
1946.
What were your duties, and who did you report to?
Well, at the beginning, I reported to Milton Rosen.
But he wasn't specifically in cosmic rays.
No, and as a matter of fact, I was. He was interested primarily in the rockets,
right.
And as a matter of fact, I think shortly after I got there, he left for a period of time to go to the JPL to study rocketry, and I was left to work on. I did some work on heating analysis of the V2s reentering, and reentering from the altitudes they could reach. It turned out their heating was not as really serious. It was the impact that was serious, but and they really knew that because although they hadn't had any, as I remember, to really high altitude, they were worried about when they'd get 100-150 miles that there would be a serious problem, but that was not true. So, and then along with those, I guess it just followed that I became the more or less the experiment integrator was my main task of putting in. They had, of course, the cosmic ray experiments, they had the ionosphere experiments, the density and temperature measurements, which were all, of course, mixed up, that you had to measure one in order to measure the other. And all of these were there. And somebody had to provide the integration, the control, the electrical, the battery power, and all of that to make sure that these were, they all worked together and they all were powered up. And it turned out, I guess, that I was either became elected or somehow or other. I don't remember how. I just became the one to do that, and trying to do some other little experiments on the side. For example, we put some cameras in the midsection of the V2 and took photographs of the Earth, and you probably have the report on that.
Yes, indeed. Let me turn the tape over.